It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Leaders of the Republican-controlled state legislature in Wisconsin made headlines the day after the election with talk about changing state law to limit the power of Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers. We turn to WPR News state capitol reporter Laurel White for the latest on this. Plus, consider the possible lame duck session to take up a proposed incentive package for consumer products company Kimberly-Clark. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Good morning, Laurel.
Good morning, John.
So Republican Governor Scott Walker's concession speech had barely hit the news wires when Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, both Republicans, were already having discussions about rewriting state law to limit the power of incoming Governor-elect Tony Evers, a Democrat. What do we know about what they're considering?
So we don't have a ton of details at this point. All we know is that Speaker Voss did come out and speak to the press room. Limiting Evers' power, potentially. And so that was kind of a conversation.
And we're having a little bit of trouble with our connection to Laurel. We're going to reestablish that. Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said some of the changes under consideration are related to Wisconsin's voter ID law specifically. He said some of the state rules governing voter ID could be a transition from administrative code, which the governor has more power over, to state law, which the governor then would not be able to do anything about. He also said that the press was making too big a deal out of this. And he said that the changes they were thinking about were quite reasonable. And here's a quote. It's equal balanced government. We'll respect Tony Evers like we have any other governor, and we'll work with him. Okay, we have Laurel back again. We're talking about proposed changes to state law being suggested by Republican legislative leaders after Tony Evers, a Democrat, was elected our next governor. So, Laurel, if you could repeat for us again what some of the changes are that they're proposing.
Mm-hmm. So we don't have a lot of details, John. What we do know is that Speaker Voss said he was open to looking at various ways that would limit the governor's power to sort of, in his words, maintain balance between the legislative branch of government and the executive branch of government. We got some details a little bit more concrete from Senator Scott Fitzgerald a little bit later in the week. He talked about codifying some of the rules that surround Wisconsin's voter ID law. And if the legislature were to do that, that would essentially give Evers a little bit more of a limited pin in terms of making changes to the ways that that law is implemented in Wisconsin. Right now, the governor could change that pretty easily. The other thing that Fitzgerald talked about was making some changes to how different state boards are composed. So right now, the governor gets to make appointments to a number of boards. He didn't get this specific, but, if it was within the realm of limiting the governor's power, I think it's safe to say maybe they'd be evaluating how many appointments the governor could make to those boards.
And what has Democratic Governor-elect Evers had to say about what the Republicans have suggested? And what do we know from the campaign about what he'd like to do when it comes, for example, to the voter ID law?
So he's mentioned the voter ID law on the campaign trail as something that he's not thrilled about. He references it in lists of things that have limited voter access to the polls, but he hasn't, I don't believe, I wasn't able to find this and I didn't experience it personally, him mentioning rolling back the voter ID law. He talked about a couple other things like supporting automatic voter registration or supporting a nonpartisan independent redistricting commission, which is something that has been floated in other states, of course, and talked about here in Wisconsin before, our 2021 redistricting. But he hasn't said anything about repealing the voter ID law specifically.
What about the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation?
So he's talked a lot about that. He talked about wanting to get rid of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation and replace it with a public option sort of like the Department of Commerce that we used to have in Wisconsin. He says that the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation hasn't done enough to be transparent or accountable to Wisconsin taxpayers, so he thinks there needs to be a pretty big change there. And I think that's why, or Fitzgerald said, that's why they want to have a little bit more oversight for that board, because Evers has expressed some concerns specifically with that organization, and Republicans want to protect it. They think it's doing a good job.
Well, of course, that was something that was a creation of Governor Scott Walker, and the power that the governor's office has was given to Scott Walker by a Republican legislature, and now it looks like they're trying to take it back. So the optics of this make it appear to be an effort to undermine a Democratic governor before he ever takes office. Senator Fitzgerald downplayed that, saying, no, that's not the case at all. How has Tony Evers responded?
Well, he has responded that he certainly believes it to be undermining of his future power. He's called it a complete violation of the separation of powers in the system, and then it goes counter to what people voted for on Election Day. They said that they wanted a Democratic governor and a Republican state legislature, and he believes for the legislature to act in a way that limits the powers that that voters assumed he would have is disingenuous and not right.
Laura White is our state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Meanwhile, there is talk about the possibility of a special session this month. What might be on the agenda?
So what might be on the agenda this month is something else entirely, and that is the Foxconn-style incentive package for consumer products company Kimberly-Clark. Folks might remember that passed the state assembly earlier this year before the legislature left Madison to begin campaign season, but it never passed the state Senate. So that's something that they've talked about coming back in after the election to take up in the state Senate.
Any idea of whether or not the Senate will have more votes for this incentive package than they did before? I mean, wasn't the reason that they didn't take it up the last time that Senator Fitzgerald didn't think he had the votes in his chamber to pass it?
Mm-hmm, that's exactly right. And that's something that Senator Fitzgerald hasn't given us a solid answer on. He said, we're going to come back to do Kimberly-Clark if we have the vote. So it's an interesting situation because, of course, it has already passed the assembly. If Senator Fitzgerald needs to agree to changes to the package to get it to pass the Senate, that would require the assembly coming back in, which is something that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, I believe, said he wasn't interested in doing for Kimberly-Clark. He has said that they'll come back in to take up other things, but not necessarily Kimberly-Clark. So it's going to be an interesting couple weeks. We'll have to see if Fitzgerald is able to get those additional Republican votes, or if he's able to reach across the aisle and get some Democratic support for the measure. That's not something that's factored into those vote totals right now.
All right. So is the legislature taking anything else up? Any talk of anything other than limiting the governor's power and the Kimberly-Clark thing for a special session?
That's definitely up in the air and something we're going to have to keep a really close eye on. They have somewhat limited power of what they can take up during a special session, but they could certainly take up some different things that we're not aware of yet.
Okay. Laura White, State Capitol Reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, thank you for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, a new report shows that if state spending stays the way it is, we're going to need more money, $2 billion more. We'll dig into that after a break for news from NPR and WPR News. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. $2 billion. That's how much money is needed just to maintain current state spending levels with modest increases, according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. And that's $2 billion we don't have yet. What do you think the state needs to do here? What do you think this means for Governor-elect Evers and the Republican-controlled legislature? What questions do you have about state spending? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jason Stein is Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum report shows the state needs more than $2 billion of additional revenue in order to balance the next state budget. Why is that?
Well, let's go through it. And again, we're making a series of assumptions here. So this number could go up or down depending on the assumptions that you make. And so first off, there's about $500 million that you need to keep existing Medicaid programs going. There's there's more than $800 million in just commitments that are written into state law that take effect in the next budget under current law. And then you can look at what is left for other programs such as prisons and education. And, you know, the one area where these assumptions do include a pretty healthy increase is for K-12 education, because we wrote it that way because both candidates for governor had talked about increasing the state's commitment to funding education to two-thirds.
Okay, so we're not just talking about maintaining the status quo. We're also talking about increasing funding for education. I get that. What questions did you ask in order to put together your report? What data did you use?
We looked at, again, what commitments are already written into state law in terms of spending or tax cuts. We looked at what would it cost to keep Medicaid health programs for the needy going at current levels. We looked at, again, what would it cost to give K-12 schools the same increase they saw in the current budget, and then 1% a year increases for every other program, and that ranges from prisons to UW.
What about increased funding for state and local roads and other infrastructure?
That we did not include because we were looking at the state's main account, which is
sure,
called its general fund, and those get paid for out of the road fund, the transportation fund. So that we did not include anything extra. It is true that at times some money has been transferred from the general fund to the transportation fund and vice versa over the years, and we didn't include any transfers either way.
What is the state's biggest expense?
K-12 education, so aid to local schools. Second biggest expense is Medicaid, and Medicaid in particular has been growing, you know, very quickly, almost at double digits, you know, in recent years. And again, you see, you know, in the next budget, the expectation being that it would be about $500 million to keep Medicaid going at current costs. K-12 education, you know, lawmakers and the next governor can decide how much they want from, you know, no increase to a large increase.
Of course, the promise that was made when local units of government accepted the property tax limitations going back to the Thompson administration in the 90s was that two-thirds of state school spending would be paid for out of general revenue. And so that's a target which has often been missed. Both gubernatorial candidates promised to make sure that schools were getting the money they need. Now it looks like that's going to be a little bit of a problem. Jason Stein is the research director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's with us to talk about these issues. Jason, your report comes in just days after the election. What do we know about what Governor-elect Tony Evers wants from the next state budget?
Well, he's talked about a $1.4 billion increase in schools for school funding. We did not include an increase at that level. We included a $620 million increase, which was what was in the current budget. You know, Governor-elect Evers has talked about wanting to take expanded federal funding for Medicaid. That would help to, you know, balance the budget on one hand. On the other hand, lawmakers have said that control of the Senate and Assembly have said that they, you know, want to stick with their current approach, which is to not take that money. So that, you know, that doesn't necessarily get resolved easily.
Okay, so what options then are on the table if the Republicans, and it's hard to imagine a Republican legislator saying yes to any kind of a tax increase, although some were open to increases of some sort of revenue to pay for state highways. But what options are on the table? Is this a problem we can cut our way out of?
Well, so there's a couple things. I mean, number one, what we're seeing right there is how much new revenues would need to be taken in taxes and fees. And, you know, as long as the economy keeps expanding, that there will be added money through that means. So, you know, typically the state takes in about, since 2012, about 2.9% more a year in taxes and fees. And that's even after a series of tax cuts. So, you know, you'd get somewhat more than that without tax cuts, probably. If you were, you know, again, going along the averages that we've had in recent years, we've calculated that for the kind of assumptions that we talked about, you'd need 3.8% revenue growth in the first year and 5.3%, I believe, in the second. So it's that first year you're pretty close. It's that second year where things would be more distant.
Jason, it really seems like we've had this conversation just about every 2 years for the entire time that I've been guest hosting on this program, going back, longer ago than I'd like to think. Wisconsin has consistently had this problem. Why is this?
Well, you know, I mean, I think a couple of the challenges are, for one, Medicaid, which is our second biggest expense, is growing very, very quickly. And so, you know, when you have some of your programs that are growing more quickly than your tax revenues, then you're always put in a position where you have to prioritize. And that is, you know, that is the work of elected officials to try and do that. You know, I should say that this is by no means the most challenging budget we've had. You know, the budgets, you know, for instance, in 2009 and 2011, both were much more challenging than this. The point that we're just making in putting this information out there is to try and, you know, help the public get a sense of what the challenges are and what the priorities might need to be in terms of that process as elected officials try and sort out what they do.
You just gave us some projected revenue forecasts for the next 4 years or so. What happens to the state budget if the economy takes a sudden turn for the worse?
Right. And that's the reality is that none of us know what is going to happen with the economy. And so that is why we really did not present ourselves or are not trying to present ourselves as giving actual forecasts. I mean, what we're saying is this is what has happened in the past, but, you know, what has happened in the past is not any guide for what will happen in the future, because, you know, sometimes there's continuity and sometimes there's not, and that's what we don't know. And I think that's one of the reasons why you try to budget as carefully as you can, because there are going to be surprises.
Let's take a quick call from Eric, who joins us from Madison. Eric, good morning.
Good morning. I have an idea. You could raise the minimum wage to $15 or $18 an hour for employees at multinational corporations like Walmart, the fast food industry, corporations that are making hundreds of millions of dollars. Raise the minimum wage for them, and the state will generate more money in income tax revenue.
All right, Eric, how do wages factor into the state's tax revenue?
Well, so again, I'll set aside that caller's proposal, and that's something that, you know, elected officials can debate. Obviously, the income tax is the state's single largest source of revenue, along with the property tax, the two sort of big taxes at the state and local level, and then the sales tax is number three. So, you know, certainly what happens to people's wages over the next 2 years will have a big impact on, you know, what the challenges are or the opportunities are in the state budget.
And, of course, the state of Wisconsin is, by its own constitution, not allowed to actually have a deficit. So we have to pay as we go. This is going to make for a very interesting legislative season. The governor proposes the budget, but then the legislature has to take it over. What are you looking for as we go forward here, Jason?
Well, I mean, I guess the question will be, because you have divided government, the governor will propose a budget, and I think it's probably safe to say that the legislature will end up passing a budget that will be quite a bit different than what the governor originally proposed. And I guess the question is, will the governor, who has a very powerful partial veto pen, will he be able to make some partial vetoes and feel that the budget is something that he can sign with those vetoes? Or, you know, will it be something that, you know, we get a budget vetoed in its entirety, which,
okay,
you know, uncharted territory.
So, in other words, it's all going to come down to who's blinking first. Jason Stein is research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Thank you for joining us, Jason. Next up on the morning show, we continue to look at what voter turnout looked like in Wisconsin. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Last week's election produced a record midterm turnout in Wisconsin and an abnormally high turnout across the rest of the country for a midterm election. We talked about that in the immediate aftermath of Tuesday, but this morning we'll dive a little deeper into the issue and talk about whether or not gerrymandering had any impact on whether people voted or not, among other things. Were you a new voter in this election? What inspired you to go to the polls? Did you stay home on election day? If so, why? And did gerrymandering have any impact on your decision whether to vote or not? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the phone number to use to join the program. You can also send an email, ideas@WPR.org, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Paru Shah is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Paru, welcome back to the morning show. Thanks for talking with us again.
Thanks for having me again.
And as I said, you joined us last week on the morning show to dig into voter turnout. Let's quickly recap what it looked like in the 2018 midterms.
Well, as you mentioned, there was record turnout both here in Wisconsin and across the nation, I think highest ever, particularly in Wisconsin. And one of the things that we talked about last week, which I think we're still kind of digging into this week, is what motivated people to go to the polls. And it sounds like it was a combination of national politics and national climate, as well as some really closely contested races in places like Wisconsin.
So national issues influenced people to vote. What were the Wisconsin issues, do you think, that drove turnout? And how do we know this?
I think for the exit poll data, it talks a lot about healthcare, which I think both in Wisconsin and nationally was something that people were particularly concerned about. And then the economy is always an important issue for every election. And we saw that again here in Wisconsin, kind of looking at how people feel about what's been happening over the last 2, 4, 6 years.
Not to do too much scoreboard watching here, but how did Wisconsin's turnout numbers reflect the rest of the nation? Were we higher, lower? Where were we?
Wisconsin actually is traditionally higher, and we maintain that again this year. So we were, I think, closer to 60%, and I think nationally we're looking at closer to 30 to 40%. So.
We're talking about voter turnout in the recent midterms here in Wisconsin. Paru Shah is associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Want to know what drove you to the polls? And don't say your 98 Volkswagen Golf, please. That would not be good. What was it that caused you to go out and vote? Was it an issue? Was it a candidate? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Democratic U.S. Senate incumbent Tammy Baldwin overcame a challenge from Republican Leah Vukmir, winning a number of counties that had delivered votes for Donald Trump in 2016. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, I would say that a couple of things. Tammy Baldwin is a strong incumbent, and while I wouldn't say that incumbents across the board did well this year, actually I think they didn't do as well as predicted maybe, Tammy is a very strong incumbent and runs a very strong campaign and has in the past. She walked in with a much larger coffer than Leah Vukmir, who quite honestly had a really tough primary to get through first, and then I think by the time she got through that primary, had a lot less money and a lot less ability to compete with Tammy at that scale. And I would say that probably Leah lost some of the national backing that other Republican candidates were getting or other candidates were getting across the country when the writing was on the wall pretty early on, where it seemed as Tammy had maintained a very strong lead over Leah, and it didn't seem like there was going to be a lot of opportunities for that to close.
Yeah, all the polls pretty much showed throughout the campaign that Tammy Baldwin had about a 10-point lead, and that's exactly what happened. She did win by that 10-point margin. Why did she outperform, for example, Tony Evers? That race, the race for governor, was a lot closer than the race for the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who in the past probably were Walker Baldwin voters. I think, again, because she's a strong incumbent, I think she has connected with a lot of voters throughout the state, particularly on health care. As I mentioned, health care, I think, was a really strong issue that motivated people this year. And so I think she kind of started off with a much stronger campaign and as an incumbent came in with a stronger candidacy versus Tony Evers, who's coming in. Yes, he has elected office, but he hadn't run for governor. And I think Scott Walker is also a very formidable incumbent. And so I think it makes sense that he would have had a tighter race.
The Washington Post said that the Republicans' redistricting advantage after the 2010 election was so huge that people wondered whether it was even possible the Democrats could win back the House. Paru, were you of this mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the redistricting that's been happening over the last, since the 2010 election, right? So I think one of the things to remember is that redistricting happens by states in different ways, and that the majority of state legislatures across the country are Republican strongholds. And so one of the things that they do is partisan gerrymandering means that a lot of those districts are going to have very safe seats for the Republicans that are already in place. And so it did seem like a very, very difficult hill to climb. I think what we saw here was that there was efforts where Democrats and other organizations realized that there was a small enough or a manageable enough margin that there was a possibility of making some difference. And so you saw that happen in the House, but I think one of the things that we didn't see, right, is happen in the Senate. And I think that's, again, one of the consequences of this partisan gerrymandering.
Well, and in the Senate races, the Democrats kind of were at a disadvantage anyway because the seats they had to defend were, a lot of them were in states that Donald Trump won by significant margins in 2016. So that wasn't entirely unexpected. In the next election, though, the shoe is going to be on the other foot, so to speak. People are talking about how the Republicans are going to have more seats to defend in states that might be less advantageous for them. So, you know, this kind of thing tends to work its way out from one election to another. Were there states where gerrymandering gave Democrats a leg up?
No, not really. I think at this point, I mean, because the Republicans have had state control at the state level for such a long time since the 2010 elections, and again, because of the way those redistricting is organized by the states and by the party in that has the seats. Mm-hmm. I think it's really difficult for Democrats to have had an advantage. The hope is that with kind of seven new Democratic governors and some movement, a little bit at least, in some of those state legislatures, we'll see something not in the 2020 election, but maybe in the 2022 election around changes in those maps.
All right, let's take a phone call here. Jeff is with us in Fond du Lac. Jeff, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Good morning. I just wanted a quick, very easy answer to your question on what it is that drove me to the polls, and that is just a civic responsibility that I've always felt since I first turned 18, which was back in the, I guess, like 1980, where Ronald Reagan was the first election that I was able to vote for. And I haven't missed a major election. There might have been some spring elections that I did always make that were minor, more minor. But I've never felt like it was one of those things. I never felt the my vote doesn't count or it doesn't make a difference or they're all crooks or whatever people use for excuses. That it's just always something, you know, I pay my taxes every year. I send in my withholding for my employees, and I vote. And I think those, it's just one of those things that I've always felt was I was responsible for.
Jeff, first of all, a tip of the morning show hat to you for your civic responsibility. Paru, is how typical a voter would Jeff be?
Jeff is what we call a consistent voter, right? Somebody who has is strongly attached to his civic responsibility. And there are a large portion of the voters that we see, particularly in midterm elections, that are always coming out. They're the ones that we can count on for midterms and for general elections. I think one of the things that happens is a couple of things. One is fatigue, election fatigue. There's a lot of elections in Wisconsin. You are probably everybody lives in a village or a town or a city where there's elections every year, and for a local municipal and county, and then the state, and then the national elections. And so I think there is a sense that some people are like, okay, I can't do it all the time. I'm going to go to the ones that I think really matter, whatever that means for them. And then also thinking through, like, okay, so what do I know about those elections? What do I really, am I prepared to vote in those elections? But I do think that one of the things that happened this year is that we're really, that there's this attempt to try to get people more attached to this idea of consistent voting, of being out there all the time, of seeing this as a civic duty. And I think organizations, as I mentioned last week, are really pushing that agenda. And I think we saw it actually work in this last midterm election.
How big a factor was Donald Trump in turnout, do you think?
I think the president is always a factor just because the midterms is the first chance for voters to vote and give some evaluation of what the president has been doing. I think he motivated people on both sides. The Democrats, I think, were motivated to come out and vote against his policies, and the Republicans were really motivated to go and support him. And so I think we saw both sides. I think we can say that he, as an unusual presidency, and so I think maybe his influence was maybe a little bit greater than we've seen in the past.
Our conversation with Paru Shah continues in a moment. When we come back, we'll talk about the impact that gerrymandering can have on voter turnout, and we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Last week, more than 2.7 million Wisconsinites cast ballots. That makes it the largest turnout for a midterm election in state history. Were you a new voter this election? What inspired you to vote? Did you stay home on election day? Why was that? Do you think gerrymandering had any impact on your decision whether or not to vote? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll go back to the phones in just a minute. Paru Shah is with us, and she is the associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Let's talk about, just for a moment, how gerrymandering can impact turnout in an election. I mean, is there evidence that people either think, hey, my candidate doesn't have a chance, so I'll stay home, or the reverse, my candidate is safe, I don't need to vote? Do we know this?
Yeah, actually we do. So one of the things that is a strong predictor of voter turnout is level of competition in a race. And so, you know, we see this actually happen a lot with how exit polls influence then whether or not people are voting, and this idea that, oh, there's something to be gained if I show up to vote. And so one of the downsides to gerrymandering is that there are these very safe districts. And we've seen this here in Wisconsin and many places where, you know, there hasn't been a change in the partisan official for a really long time. And often then the opposing party doesn't even bother putting up somebody in opposition, right? The elections cost money, and there's some sort of resources that would be needed to use to do that. And so you end up with either an uncontested election or an election with an opponent that's really not what we might call a weak opponent. And so this definitely affects the voters, because if you know, everybody has limited time and resources as well. And so if you feel like, look, it's not going to really matter one way or the other if I show up, the person who's on the ballot is guaranteed a seat, you're not going to see people show up.
Of course, we had safe districts in Wisconsin before 2010. What changed then?
So one of the things that really, I think, influenced what happened after 2010 is, again, the landslide of elections that Republicans had at the state legislative level. And there is this, I think, a new kind of technology involved in terms of creating these districts that is very, very specific to maintaining then partisan gerrymandering. And so for the last 10 years, because that's who's been in charge in terms of who creates those lines, we've seen these very specifically organized districts where it's very, very difficult for the opposite party. So if it's a Democratic district, it's very strongly Democratic. And if it's Republican, it's very strongly Republican. It's very difficult for them to make any move given who the voters are in those districts.
Let's invite Dave from Oconomowoc to join us. Dave, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Thank you for taking my call. And my question is on the marijuana vote. Why were certain counties allowed to vote that were counties with a lot of college students in it that would vote because of the marijuana law? Why were they allowed to vote and not the rest of the state?
Dave, thanks for that. There were a number of referenda on ballots around the state of Wisconsin on various things, including local property taxes. Some communities had a number of different ballot initiatives on marijuana, and some people are saying that drove voting in those districts. Parushaw, what do you have? How can you answer Dave's question?
Yeah, so ballot initiatives and referendum can take a couple of forms. And so some of the ones that you're talking about, like, and there was a lot of school referendum as well, school districts, those are binding. And so they were actually going to lead to some sort of legislative or policy change. The marijuana referendum was really, it's a non-binding one. And really it's an opportunity for the legislature to get a pulse of what the community is thinking. So you might think of it as a survey, like, so what would people say if we put this on, if we move towards this? And so only certain legislators and counties were interested in finding that out. And so do I think they did it to drive up voter participation? No, it just happened to be that I think it did do so, because there are a lot of people who wanted to voice their opinion on that. I do think there's a national mood towards legalization of marijuana, and I think Wisconsin, I would guess, would want to see like where we fall within that and within that spectrum of changing our laws.
And to Dave's point about why the whole state didn't vote on it, these were not statewide referenda. These were counties and municipalities who had these on their ballots. These were locally generated referenda, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. Dave, thanks for that call. Let's go to Joanne in Eau Claire next. Joanne, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. My question today is with regard to, are there any figures yet for the midterm election in Wisconsin with regard to votes cast versus votes wasted? Because a larger voter turnout favors the Democrats. We had a very large voter turnout, and we took no seats in our state assembly nor in our state senate. And I find that very disturbing. So I'm wondering when those figures might be out as to votes cast versus votes wasted. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
All right. Thank you, Joanne. Votes cast, votes wasted. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, I actually don't know those numbers yet, but the idea of whether or not the votes were wasted, I think, really gets again towards the idea of redistricting and gerrymandering. So the caller, I think, specifically talks about the fact that we can have in Wisconsin the popular vote go heavily towards the Democratic Party and still not gain any seats because of the way the seats are drawn. And again, this is, I think, the main argument that we're seeing in this fair elections case that we hope, you know, gets seen by the Supreme Court, that this is by definition unfair, right? That it's not actually capturing what the voters really want. So,
all right, let's Joanne, thanks for the call. Let's go to Julie next in Milwaukee. Julie, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I was just calling in response to your question as to what drove people to the polls. And as I mentioned to your screener, I come from a family that we traditionally do vote in pretty much every election, local, statewide, etc. We've got family and friends on both sides of the aisle, but overwhelmingly we all made sure we turned out and voted, first and foremost because of the current administration in Washington and the absolute lack of governing on the Republican side to put any type of checks or balances on this current administration, which is very disturbing at a personal and professional level. So I just wanted to give my feedback regarding that. We vote regardless, but this definitely was a motivating factor in this particular election.
Julie, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us this morning. Parisha, what did the midterms convey about the level of enthusiasm in the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party?
I mean, I think there is enthusiasm in both parties still. I think that it's the Democrats now need to think about the next 2 years and how they're going to be able to demonstrate that they can make a difference and actually pass some legislation. I think it's difficult for voters to continue to vote against a party and not feel like they're voting with their own party. I think the Republicans are in the same place, actually. The caller just mentioned this lack of checks and balances, disappointment among some Republicans about what this administration has been doing. And so the next 2 years are really their opportunity to show that, okay, we can meet some of those more centrist or less marginalized voters and say, like, okay, we can actually pass something, because I think people are not going to be impressed with two parties that refuse to work with each other for the next 2 years. That will not be something that helps with voter turnout, I don't think, in 2020.
Yeah, and if you look at the output of Congress, they make the Truman administration's do-nothing Congress look like overachievers. Not much happening in Washington, people getting frustrated. Paru Shah, thank you for joining us again on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me again.
Paru Shah, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.